Hello, Kevin here. I hope you're safe and well. It's hard to know what day it is, but this should be a listener's questions episode. But please note, it was recorded just before football was postponed because of you know what. Hello and welcome to the Price of Football podcast, the podcast that follows the money behind the beautiful game. I said that a bit too loudly there, Kieran, didn't I? You jumped slightly.
You woke me up.
Sorry about that. Yeah, because normally you're like a ninja, you're totally impassive. There's no movement. When your body doesn't require you to move, you don't move at all. You're in the jungle. You're like you can't see you on a tree. But now you're alert. You're awake. I've waved the spreadsheet in front of you. Kieran Maguire is the a lecturer in football finance at Liverpool University. He's the prophet in our books. He's the guru. It's a Monday again. We say that every week. It's a Monday again. They keep coming around Mondays. So that means, of course, that the Price of Football is driven by your questions. And we've got a very interesting selection. So coming up, we've got another visit to Germany. We've talked about that recently, and there's been quite a bit of feedback. We're going to Portsmouth. We're going to talk about player pensions. And we're going to talk about whether players can be self-employed. So there's some proper accountancy stuff for you. Yeah, so you can
sexy.
Yeah, you want to take a big deep breath before we plunge in? Don't want to calm you down a little bit with. Now, Mark Ridley has asked our first question. Again, it's one of those questions. It's almost so simple, but yet it's actually quite significant because Mark points out that, you know, sensible Premier League players will stop playing football around the age of 35 and hopefully never have to work again. Because they'll have earned so much money and invested it wisely, or their agent would have done for them. But his question is about lower league players. I mean, if a lower league player retires at 35, is there a pension? Do the PFA give them a pension? Is there any kind of payoff? Do the club give them a payout? Or do they just hopefully got enough money to live on, or like they did in the old days, have to buy a pub?
Well, under the... And here I'm indebted to a guy called Ian Goodwin, who's a tax expert. For accountants, taxes is our favourite three-letter word ending in X. In fact, for many of them, it's the only three-letter word ending in X in their lives.
Not the Baron.
And until 2006, a player, if he'd paid money into a pension scheme, was able to retire and draw down on that pension. But the rules have been changed. And
was this a PFA pension scheme? Or
this was an EFL, effectively. It would be organised by the clubs. And that was fine, except the pensions weren't very good. Because if you're a lower league player, effectively, it was linked to the amounts that you were paying in.
Right.
So, given that you're likely to live till 80, then 45 years.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really worth happening. HMRC have changed the rules. Footballers can now take their pension from the age of 55. So they've got a long time to wait from retiring within the game.
They can't get it at 35.
They can't take it out. No.
They've got to wait
until they're 55. But it's probably doing them a favour, because if they started taking it at 35, what the actuaries would say, well, hold on, you're not going to die for another 45 years. This is how much money you paid into the scheme. Spread that over 45 years. You're going to get buttons each year.
Remind me what an actuary is. I mean, I do know, but there might be people listening to this who don't know what an actuary is.
An actuary is a mathematical genius who works out when you're going to die.
Oh, okay. It sounds a bit like my wife, but without the mathematical genius thing. It was more of a prediction in her case sometimes. So in that case, then, that 20 years on, then presumably that will be accruing interest, and so it will be a quite decent lump sum.
Yep, and the player would be able to, of course, contribute towards that pension if they move into another career. You can put all of your money into a single pension pot.
And obviously they can do stuff, because I'm lucky. I mean, I'm freelance, but I can work. I have to work forever, basically. But nominally, I've got other pension schemes. So presumably, footballers would be advised to do that as well, would they?
And I think here's one of the biggest problems for footballers is that. As we tend to live lifestyles and we get involved in a certain level of expenditure, and when you retire, you've still got all of your lifestyle expenses from the cars that you've got, the houses you've got, the expectations in terms of where your family expect to go on holiday and things of this nature, and all of a sudden the income stops. And that's the biggest problem that they have, and that's why 40% of players become bankrupt.
40%? You've said that before. It's an astonishing figure, isn't it?
Yeah.
They should be like you, because your biggest luxury is iced water, isn't it?
It is.
It's, literally, it's your biggest luxury is ice. That's what a party animal. Kieran is very proud of his, what is it, his reverse vacuum that keeps your water icy cold.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Amazing.
The reason these Monday pods are short is because I can't get through half an hour without a bottle of wine. And you carry your iced water with you at all times. That's a good question, Mark. Thank you. And that's a distressing fact. It does seem that PFA have got work to do in terms of financial instruction for, because I mean they join a club at a very early age. They're not exposed to financial education. Our schools don't do enough to teach financial education, do they?
No. I mean, I've worked for a charity called Young Enterprise, which goes into schools and tries to give kids an understanding as to, you know, what money means and how it works. And you know, just now, you know, that if the fact that charities having to do the work, which should be done by, should be part of the national curriculum, isn't a vote of confidence in the way that we have our education system. I think one of the big problems we've got in football is that you're dealing with young men who aren't financially literate, because why should they be the case? They therefore become reliant upon their managers and advisors, who the minute that they retire disappear.
Yes, of course. Well, there you go. But luckily, there's another end to the financial scale, and Man City are very much it. There's a question from Luke Slater. The Man City thing is rumbling on, of course. Still no outcome as to the appeal. Luke says, assuming that the ban is upheld, could it actually possibly work in City's favour? Because I guess that they'll just spend, or rather Luke guesses, that they'll just spend Champions League weeks playing, you know, lucrative friendlies across the globe, won't they?
Well, whilst that's possible, there's two issues here. First of all, there is the travel issue. I don't think the manager would be over keen on losing the players for 2 or 3 days, schlepping it all over the world. And secondly, you've got to ask yourself, who's the opposition going to be? Because the one thing which really came out of the Manchester City ruling was the undisguised glee of other major clubs in Europe. So they're already in the Champions League themselves, so that's going to take away those oppositions.
Yeah.
So who are you going to be playing? Is it going to be the Tokyo All-Stars 11 against a Manchester City 11? You're going through so many time zones. I don't think that would be very, very much in the interests of player development. Surely Manchester City will just spend that season making sure that they hoover up the Premier League.
Yeah. Or they could turn themselves into the football equivalent of the Harlem Globetrotters and make a cartoon, which is going to mean nothing to anybody under the age of 45 listening to this. They used to brighten up a bank holiday Monday, didn't they?
The
Harlem
amazing.
Globetrotters, yeah. Medal Art Lemon. Oh, those are the days. Let's just pause for a moment while two middle-aged men peer back nostalgically to a time which was dreadful to live through. Chris Minter's got a question. We talked about the chaos caused by the Hoffenheim owner and the protests in Germany. And I think we've talked about quite often about how English football fans who have our sort of romance and love for the game look across to Germany as the ideal way to do it. And there's a lot of English fans who follow St. Pauli, which is Hamburg's other team, a traditional left-wing working-class team, which has garnered them some support over here. So Chris, basically, is a St. Pauli fan, would like to know about their commercial side. How do they sustain themselves in crowds of about 20,000, 25,000, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they've got a 30,000 capacity stadium. They practically sell out every match. What I think is noticeable about St. Pauli is that for a club in Bundesliga 2, I took a look at their most recent accounts, that they're generating income of €55 million a year, of which a very significant chunk of that is coming from the commercial arm, because they have invented themselves as the anti-heroes not only German football, but I think European football as a whole. They've got a ground where there's 17,000 standing area, which is great in terms of the vibe that they want to create. It's like an amazing experience to go there.
Union Berlin, similar sort of vibe, basically.
Yep.
And I'm guessing as well, St. Pauli, there's a lot of... I went onto their website because I'd like to do some research. It would be quite nice if you and I could agree how you pronounce their name, but that's part of the mystique of this pod, isn't it, really? Somebody German will tell us, and then you'll insult them for being arrogant, which is another of your memes. I guess there's probably 1,000 non-German football fans at every St. Pauli game, because their website is covered in social media sites from St. Pauli fan groups from in Glasgow, Manchester, London, all over Italy, Holland. You've got people who probably have a similar view to football that we have who follow them and go to games a lot.
Yes, and I think that they have they've tapped into that without selling out. I mean, they've got their list of, you know, five or six principles by which they stand in terms of we represent this area of Hamburg, and we want to reflect the values of our local community. And you read that and you do feel sort of, you know, a bit of a swell in the heart and so on. I think they've been quite clever in the way that they want to be seen as a development club as well. So if you take a look at the Bundesliga TV deal, a part of that money is based on the number of minutes of play that you give to players who are under 23. So St. Pauli have gone for that.
That's very progressive from the TV company, isn't it?
I think it's come from the Bundesliga itself.
Oh, okay. Because
the TV company says, here's a load of money. How you split it up is down to you.
The Bundesliga does sound cool.
Yeah, I think there are so many things which are cool about German football.
Yeah, that we could learn.
With the exception of the way the Bundesliga deals with racism in their own sport. So, yeah, at least that is being highlighted.
I hate using this expression, but there's no way around it sometimes because I haven't got the imagination to find another word, even though I'm a wordsmith. The narrative of St. Pauli is almost not suited by being in the Bundesliga, which from their point of view, as a club that sells itself as an outsider, as an underdog, is quite a clever way of marketing yourself, isn't it, really? Because to not being in the Bundesliga, in the top division, isn't a disaster for them, is it?
No. I mean, you know, to be generating that level of income for a second division club, given that German clubs in general are far less wealthy than English clubs because the German TV deal is significantly lower, I think is testament to their ability to tap into all of these fan groups from all over Europe, because a bit like when fans go to Old Trafford, you go to Hamburg and you buy the shirt and you buy the beanie hat and you drink an awful lot in the ground itself, and yeah, we're all toasting each other in terms of, you know, solidarity and bondship and all of this, and the club makes money on the back of that. But that's fine. It doesn't make profits. It breaks even each year because the business model is that we're not being funded by outside sources. We don't have a sugar daddy. We are a community club, and therefore we don't expect the community to subsidise us.
Does it ever occur to you, Kieran, that if every fan was like you and only drank iced water, most of the clubs in this country would go under? If 25,000 fans would say, I don't want the beer, I'll just have the ice water, just clubs would be losing money hand over fist. People like me are keeping football going.
That's very commendable.
It is, isn't it?
That's why you do my drinking for me.
Selfless heavy drinkers like me that are keeping local businesses in the form of pubs and football teams going. Thank you, Carlsberg. You're welcome. Did I ever get a thank you? Of course you don't. Sean McCarthy, not a week goes by without us mentioning Bury. And Sean McCarthy makes a very interesting point, actually, because he says Portsmouth, a while ago, after their glory years in the Premier League, sank to the lowest depths and were in a shockingly bad financial situation, arguably worse than Bury's was at the end. So his question basically is, why do some clubs manage a miracle when other clubs, like Bury, not able to do so? Can you find similarities and differences in such different cases?
Well, I think the main difference is that Portsmouth was played by a series of owners as a form of pass the parcel. And each owner tried to sell it to find another mug to buy it at a slightly higher price. Eventually, the music stopped with regards to that particular game. And the owners at that point realised that the game was up. The club went into administration. The difference with Bury is that Bury have never been put into administration. Steve Dale is still the owner of Bury Football Club.
Right, okay.
And the reason for that is that he is a horrible human being. That's fine.
Legally, we're fine with that.
I'm perfectly happy with that. But he's playing a long game. The local council at Bury have said, you can only sell it and it be used as a football ground. Now, they're saying that in 2020. Dale's smart enough to realise is that he just sits on it for 3 or 4 years. It becomes overgrown. You then get a different council.
Yeah.
Bit of vandalism. You get a travellers' community moving on the pitch and everybody's kicking off and
similar
all of these things.
Similar thing to Newport. It's happened at other clubs, hasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And then he goes to the council and says, look, one way of dealing with this is let me do this space for redevelopment for commercial or retail or for dwellings, and then the council would say, well, that now appears to be the lesser of two evils,
yeah.
And the words Kurt and Ching are put together.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
That's heartbreaking, isn't it? I really wish we could get through a couple of weeks without mention of that man's name. I hesitate to, which again, we can only say we send our good wishes to everybody trying to revive Bury Football Club, whichever Phoenix club is the one that prevails. Phil Shadwell asked a question that actually has echoes of my world, the world of show business, which is technically what I'm in. By the skin of my teeth.
And well, you're sharing a room with me, so call that show business.
Now, this is a good question. This didn't occur to that it could possibly happen. Now, in my world, this is an issue, certainly the BBC, where some high-profile performers aren't paid as employees at the BBC. They're paid as businesses. So his question is, can a player be paid as a business and therefore only pay 90% corporation tax, or are they all club employees and therefore liable to pay the highest 40% income tax?
Right. At present, there are a number of investigations by HMRC into the tax affairs of football clubs, agents and players. A lot has to do with this very issue.
Right.
What some players' contracts have said is that, let's say that the player is on £100,000 a week, and therefore half of that is going to be for the player's image rights, and the image rights are paid to a separate company.
So would that not be in the contract?
That could be in the contract.
Right.
And that's legal.
Right.
But what the revenue will then say is, well, actually, the reason why you've signed that contract in such a particular way is because if the player's on £100,000 a week, then he should be paying income tax at 45%.
Right.
And what you've tried to do is to organise his tax affairs in such a way that the half of the money is going to the company. The company is then paying tax at 19%. And what the company will do is it will simply keep that money, keep all the non-tax element within the company. And then when the player retires, they start to pay him out a wage. And therefore, he's paying tax at a lower rate. Or
right.
What they might do alternatively is, again, the image rights company gets the money, and then the image rights company employs the player's parents, siblings, wags, and so on, and therefore they end up paying tax at a lower rate. So there's various silver-tongued people within the community that are doing that. What the revenue have said is that we're not particularly happy with that. So here's the deal: you can pay, let's say, I think they normally have a ceiling of 20%. So if 20% of your income goes to the image rights company, we're fine with that. Anything above, we're going to investigate a little bit more closely.
Yeah, what's depressing about this as well, these shenanigans, I think we're allowed to call them.
I think that's a tax word.
Is that 2 weeks ago you were telling me about the EFL stopping Accrington's chairman buying his own players fish and chips because that's not in their contract. And yet these sort of financial games that are 30 miles down the road are going on. Mm. It's just not right. Anyway.
Accounting and morality aren't words in the same sentence.
Well, I'm increasingly learning. Every time I go out to the pub with you for an iced water, I'm learning that very much. Your morals of an alley cat, this man's got. The Aristocats would have been a worse film, wouldn't it, if all the cats were accountants? And that's just by the way. A final question is from Daniel Walker. Now, this follows a discussion we had recently about Villa. And your tweet that you sent that had no meaning whatsoever, just facts, which caused some issues. But Daniel, his question is, you know, we had, they're free of any FFP suspicion. That's over as far as you're concerned. They're happy with the valuation of the ground that they sold to themselves, etc. But Daniel's question, if Villa go down, what are the ramifications in general for their finance? And will they have the same? Remember, QPR had issues with suspended FFP problems, but that was, that's gone now. So that the second part of that question presumably doesn't exist. So we're only talking about potential financial ramifications if Villa go down, are we?
I think the ramifications are that all of a sudden you lose 60 or 70 million pounds of TV money, and you've got to cut your cloth accordingly. Could they face sanctions by the EFL? What we now have...
Because they lost... They operated at a terrific loss in the Championship, didn't they, before?
They did. But what you're allowed to do under FFP... I did a calculation of Villa's FFP, which showed that they actually lost £176 million in 3 years. The FFP limit is 39. And then I went through on a line-by-line basis showing how, actually, by the time you put through all of these... allowable adjustments, you were down to 17 million and Villa seemed to qualify mainly on the back of selling Villa Park to themselves,
right,
even though they've not been paid for it. And this is the crazy thing.
What do you mean they've not been paid for it?
If you take a look at the accounts, it says they've sold the ground for £57 million.
That's not given themselves the money.
But they've not given themselves the money.
Every now and again on this pod, I'm a quick thinking man. I'm normally able to keep up with what we were saying. How can that? Well, how's that right?
Well, they say they owe themselves £57 million. They've not got round to paying it. Now,
what?
I know.
On that basis, I owe myself £500,000. I've just decided. How can that be allowed?
Because
this is no comment on Villa, by it.
No.
I'm saying this if this was any club. This is not a criticism of Villa's. I don't want a repeat of that terrible, terrible, what we call Villa Day in my house now, where I forgot to mute, silence Twitter, and I got involved in all the angry arguments. How is that allowed?
Well, for me...
Is it allowed?
It's allowed under the EFL rules. If you take a look at Sheffield Wednesday and the sale of Hillsborough, exactly the same thing has occurred. Now, if you think about your most precious asset, which is going to be, apart from the good lady wife, of course, is going to be your house.
Well, my son listens to this, so let's throw him
in. Okay, right. And the cat.
And the cat, obviously. Yeah. You've met the cat.
Yeah. Met the cat. If you think about the sale of your house, the one thing that you do when you sell a house is you make sure... The person that's buying it from you has paid you,
of course, or is able to pay you that. But
yeah, because you can't, because you're looking to move on.
Yeah, or mortgage companies do that. There are people that do that for me.
Exactly, you make damn sure, and that's the job of your solicitor. What we've seen in the cases of both Sheffield Wednesday and Aston Villa is that the properties have been sold to other companies, and these other companies have simply not paid for the football stadium.
So could that go on indefinitely? Yep. Does it not come a stage where the EFL or the Premier League say, when are they paying you?
I don't think the EFL or the Premier League will get involved. They said, we investigated you in the year that the sale went through. If we're happy with those prices, we'll move on and investigate something else.
I mean, God knows I'm not an expert. We all know that. Everybody listens to this. But that seems like a major loophole to me, doesn't it?
Yep.
You're more calm about it than I am, aren't you? I said last week 28 stories, and that's because this makes 29 stories now we're going to have to keep an eye on, because I genuinely am taken aback by that information. I see the logic of a club selling the ground to itself. I get that. Whether it's right or wrong.
It's the club owner that's buying it, in effect.
But I see the logic of that and how that works. But to say it's sold, but we haven't paid, I don't... I'm generally flabbergasted.
Yeah, go home tonight, sell your own house to yourself for £1 million and say, I've just made a load of money, Kevin. I'll pay you in a few years' time.
Well, OK, so next time we do the pod, I'll be a millionaire.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there'll be two millionaires on the pod next time. You'll be the accountancy millionaire, I'll be the fake, made-up millionaire.
Well, we've also got producer Guy sitting in the other
room.
The
real millionaire. Well, yes. there's always the Illuminati who work at levels above us, mere people. Literally, I feel like Steve Coogan on that bombshell. We leave. The Price of Football has been Adaptive Production. If you have questions about Villa or any of the other 28 running stories we now have, Which is not, but we're not far short of half the club so far. We've only been doing this 6 months. Questions at priceoffootball.com, and leave your good reviews for us. Leave bad reviews if you want. I don't read them. They're only drawn to my attention.
So as long, you can write anything you want, as long as it's 5 stars.
Yeah, I'm only assuming we get a good review. I'm because I presume Guy doesn't tell me about the bad reviews because he knows how sensitive I am.
We get very good reviews.
I know we do. I know. Well, the ones I'm told about. We get good numbers, and one day we'll actually get paid for it.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.